From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, teaching girls the facts of life with the help of a new book, we talk with award-winning children's author Mavis Jukes about her book It's a Girl Thing, which covers everything from getting your first bra to avoiding AIDS. The book combines information with Jukes' own reminiscences about coming of age and learning the facts of life. Also, we meet Chastity Bono, daughter of Sonny and Cher. She was outed by the tabloid press several years before she was ready to come out. Now she's a gay activist who works with the entertainment industry. Recently, she was a consultant for the coming-out episodes of Ellen. And rock historian Ed Ward tells us the truth about what happened to the 1950s teenage idol Frankie Lyman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israeli Foreign Minister David Levy says Israeli-Palestinian peace talks will resume within a week. The negotiations have been stalled since March. Levy, with Palestinian Planning Minister Nabil Shath, announced bilateral committees that will meet to resolve outstanding issues in the peace process. Levy says Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has assured him that the Palestinian Authority will resume security cooperation and that Arafat is committed to preventing violence. Meanwhile, Israel has suspended the building permit for a controversial Jewish housing project in East Jerusalem. From Jerusalem, NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
Israel's interior ministry said construction at the Jerusalem site could not begin until the courts hear an appeal filed by two left-wing members of the Jerusalem City Council. That could take weeks, possibly months. Last week, Jerusalem Mayor Ehud Olmert approved plans for a 70-unit housing project in the middle of the Arab neighborhood of Ras Al Amud. Palestinian officials were furious. They say the project would mean an end to the peace process. It was construction of another Jewish settlement in Jerusalem, begun 5 months ago, that led to the current deadlock. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel maintains the right to build anywhere in Jerusalem, but he is opposed to this latest project because, he says, the time is not right. This is Eric Weiner in Jerusalem.
Switzerland's largest bank confirms that papers found in a shredder room by a night watchman may have been related to property sold by Jews under the Nazi regime. The Union Bank of Switzerland had been saying the papers were not connected to dormant accounts of Holocaust victims. Massachusetts Governor William Weld has decided to resign and pursue the post of U.S. ambassador to Mexico. His nomination is strongly opposed by Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Jesse Helms. UPI's Dave Haskell reports.
Some political observers say Weld's nomination is doomed because of his criticism of the one man who has the power to block the appointment, North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms. Weld has called an afternoon news conference in Boston to announce his resignation, effective at 5 p.m. on Tuesday. The moderate Republican plans to go to Washington on Thursday to lobby for the ambassadorship. Weld reportedly wants to focus his energies on overcoming opposition to his nomination from Helms, who has the power to block the diplomatic appointment by refusing to schedule hearings before his Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Dave Haskell, Boston.
Tennessee authorities say two people are dead after an explosion at a highway construction site in Nashville. 14 people are hurt. One person is missing. The Nashville Fire Department says the dead are construction workers and the injured include motorists. A state transportation spokeswoman says workers were planning to set off some dynamite to widen a road along a bluff. On Wall Street, the Dow's up 32 points at 81.44. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is mixed and trading within a narrow range. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors are refraining from making big bets ahead of this week's heavy schedule of economic surveys, beginning with tomorrow's report on employment cost. There is strength today among auto stocks, particularly General Motors. The UAW has ended a strike at a GM transmission plant in Michigan and ratified a local contract. It's also been a busy day of mergers. In the insurance industry, Lincoln National is buying Cigna's life insurance unit, and fertilizer maker IMC Global is expanding through the acquisition of Freeport-McMoRan. On the other hand, computer system shares are lower after Bear Stearns made negative comments on Dell Computer. I'm Doug Prisner.
This just in, General Ronald Fogelman, the Air Force Chief of Staff, has asked to retire ahead of schedule for a variety of reasons. He handed in his resignation today to Air Force Secretary Widnall. There are differences in the Air Force over responsibility for a terrorist blast last year in Saudi Arabia that claimed 19 airmen's lives. President Clinton and House Speaker Newt Gingrich say negotiations to wrap up a budget agreement are nearly finished. The president says chances are excellent that negotiators will complete outstanding issues very soon. Speaker Gingrich says the outstanding issues are tiny, but White House economic advisor Gene Sperling says the outstanding issues are thorny ones. More health insurance coverage for low-income children and who'll benefit from proposed tax cuts. Again on Wall Street, the Dow's up 32 points. The NASDAQ is down 2 points at 1567. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 160 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When it's time for a parent to teach the so-called facts of life, it can be helpful to have a good book addressed to children to help explain this new confusing territory. But let's face it, some of us are still laughing at the absurd books we were given as kids. Now there's a new informative but chatty book called It's a Girl Thing that's addressed to girls who are just beginning puberty. As the author Mavis Jukes says in the opening page, the book talks about breasts, pubic hair, underarm perspiration, and menstruation, bras, deodorant, tampons, pads, sex, sexuality, pregnancy, birth control, and sexually transmitted diseases. Jukes' goal is to introduce crucial information to preteens so that they can make safe choices as teenagers. We're going to have an adult conversation about teaching girls about sexuality, so use your judgment in deciding whether this is appropriate for your children to hear. Mavis Jukes is an elementary school teacher and an award-winning author of books for children and teenagers. Her new book mixes information with a series of personal reminiscences about Jukes' own coming of age and how she learned the facts of life. Here's a reading.
I knew all the basics about womanhood because my mother never locked me out of her bathroom. I was a member of an exclusive organization, the Ladies' Business Club. Most mornings, my mother took a shower, but sometimes she just gave herself a quick sponge bath. Naked, she'd fill the sink and wash her armpits, crotch, and rear with a soapy washcloth. She rinsed herself, carefully wringing out the washcloth, often humming a tune. A few days each month, after she had bathed and dried off, my mother climbed into a thin elastic belt. She turned it around so there was one hook in the front and one in the back. Then she hooked a big white pad onto the clips. Next, she put on a garter belt. Then she put on cotton underwear and pulled the garters, which were attached to elastic ribbons, down through the leg holes. She attached stockings, which had seams up the back, to the garters. She bent over when she fastened her bra so her breasts were in the right place when she stood up. She then pulled a slip over her head and put on a blouse and buttoned it. She stepped into a skirt and zipped it up the side. She put on high-heeled shoes, then she brushed her hair. Finally, she put on perfume and lipstick, earrings and beads or a pin. Later, if I happened to walk into the bathroom when it was time for my mom to change her pad, she wouldn't even seem embarrassed. She would just sit on the pot, chatting about this or that. I would watch with interest as she unhooked the pad from the elastic belt, front and back, rolled it up, wrapped it in newspaper, and threw it into the trash. Then I would hand her a new pad out of the box in the bathroom cupboard. She would attach it to the hooks on the elastic belt. Sometimes she would sprinkle on a little deodorant powder, which came in a small tin can.
Mavis Jukes, I think so many people will think back to their childhood hearing that passage, that so many daughters grew up watching their mothers and learning that way. And, you know, having you read that passage made me realize how long ago our childhoods must seem to girls today. Even the fact that there were no maxi pads with adhesives back then, that you had to wear, you know, belts to hook the sanitary napkins onto.
Right, and no winged pads and no pads with Velcro.
Now, it's interesting. Obviously, your mother wasn't shy about her body around you, and you learned a little bit about menstruation watching your mother. Was your mother also comfortable talking to you about the, quote, facts of life, about anything sexual?
Well, no. I mean, it was like the mid-50s. And, You know, the facts of life were really delivered to all of us in three or four sentences, always followed up with, well, if you have any questions, just ask. And then, of course, you know, we couldn't think of any questions. And there was so little information given, I didn't even know what to ask about, really. But we mainly found out about that from our friends. A lot of the misinformation was passed around through our friends.
Your new book is a book for young people about sex and intercourse and puberty and all the things that go along with that. What books did you have to explain the facts of life when you were a girl?
Well, actually, there weren't many around. There was one that I remember called Now You Are 10. But then sometimes the companies that made sanitary napkins, like Modest, for example, would put out these little brochures that would give the basics about having a period. And I remember clearly that the explanation about sex in the books was about human reproduction, actually. It went something like this. After this egg is fertilized, it grows into a little embryo, and then it turns into a fetus, and then into a baby, and then the baby is born. And I remember searching back through those brochures or that book over and over again, thinking, what is with the fertilizer? Why is the fertilizer not mentioned, and what is it? And then how the baby was born was also equally a mystery. Like, where did it come out? Because I, for one, was totally unaware of the fact that I even had a vagina, and I couldn't imagine where a baby might get out except possibly through the belly button. But those were the books that were available, ones that basically talked about periods and then sort of skipped the sex part and talked about giving birth without giving any details.
I remember in a book that I was given, and the word inserted was used, and I think inserted was used in a lot of these books about, you know, the penis was inserted into the vagina. And you'd think that maybe you needed like a T-square or, you know, other like carpentry tools to make this work. The language was just so technical.
Maybe so, but you were lucky that they even referred to the penis in your book. I mean, you know, I must be quite a bit older than you are, because in mine there was no mention of male body parts. It was all just kind of carefully skipped over.
So the literature that you had, the pamphlets and the books, weren't very helpful. They just left you with a lot of questions like, well, what is the fertilizer?
Right, right, exactly.
So how did you really get the story on this? Did your mother give it to you? Did you learn it from other kids?
Absolutely not. I'll never forget it as long as I live. You know, the phone rang, and the conversation went like this. My first name is Dorothy, and kids, when I was young, used to call me Dottie. So it was like, Dottie, Maureen. And it was my new friend, Maureen Amersano, who'd moved from the city to the country where I lived. And then it went something like, did you know that to get a baby, a man puts his you-know-what into the woman's you-know-what? And then, you know, I said something like, well, of course I knew that, and then quickly hung up the phone. But of course, I didn't know that, and I wasn't even sure what a woman's you-know-what was. I'm pretty sure what a man's you-know-what was, but so I immediately called everyone I knew and casually told them the same information.
Now, when you first learned the facts of life, you learned what was required for procreation. Did you have any clue that sex not only led to babies, but that it was pleasurable, that there was such a thing as sexual pleasure?
No. I didn't even really, basically, that's a great question, because basically looking back, I didn't even know that sex had anything to do with anything. I just thought that this, you know, the act of sexual intercourse or the act of intercourse was to get a baby. And the sex part of it didn't even enter into the equation for me. I just figured something people had to put up with doing if they wanted to have a family.
You know, I think it's sometimes very disturbing to girls when they learn about childbirth. I mean, as kind of confusing and shocking as sex seems when you first find out about it, childbirth is that way too. And I think girls wonder, how can a baby possibly fit through this part of their body that they may not even have known existed, and that is obviously really small. And I think you deal with that in a really amusing and sensitive way. You want to discuss that a little bit? First of all, you have ouch written
right
in these large letters across the page, acknowledging that this might be a real surprise to you. How does your body accommodate this infant?
Right. Well, one of the things that I mentioned is, you know, the question of how a baby will fit out of an opening that small. You know, that's a question I continued to ask myself throughout my pregnancy as an adult. It's a very, very good question. And really the answer to the question is, ouch. You know, we all know that our body, you know, our hips move and shift and things change to make it easier for a child to pass through the birth canal. But honestly, I mean, anybody can put two and two together and figure out that it's a tight squeeze. So I just told the girls the truth about it.
You know, in your book, you write a little bit about your own experiences when you were learning about sexuality and childbirth and when you were going through puberty. And you write about how desperately you wanted a bra.
Yeah.
And what it was like to shop for that first bra. Reminisce for us a little bit why that was such a powerful experience, why you wanted one so badly.
I just ached for a bra. I just yearned and longed for a bra. You know, there's never anything I wanted more in my life except for possibly a horse.
What did it mean to you?
It must have meant some kind of symbol of power, that I was growing up, that I was, you know, becoming an adult or something. But mainly it was just that I loved the idea of having a bra. And I really, really didn't need one. I had actually planned to have very large breasts when I grew up. And I just, you know, was just banking on that. And it was hard sort of waiting for that to happen. In fact, it never happened. But when I was, even 10 years old or 11, with just simply nothing to put in a bra, I really wanted one. And I told the story in the book of how I would practice asking my mom in my mind, could I have a bra? And the words would just never come out. And that suddenly the words kind of tumbled out one day and we went and shopped for one. And I will truly never forget just the smell of that bra when I took it out of the box. It just smelled so delicious.
Now, I remember on assembly days, which I think were twice a week in my grade school, you had to wear a white shirt. And you could see beneath the white shirt whether a girl was wearing an undershirt or a bra. And it started to become really important that when someone looked beneath that white shirt that you were wearing a mature bra and not a kid undershirt.
Absolutely.
Did you go through that?
No, but if there had been an assembly day at my school where I was required to wear a white shirt, I'm sure that I would have popped the question to my mother way earlier than that, because I really wanted to be in a leadership position in all ways when I was a kid, including, you know, first with the bra, first with the period, and so on. Now, I was out of luck with my period because I didn't start my period till I was 14 years old, but I was able to find a way around that, which was that I just lied about it to my friends and, you know, said that I had started months before I had actually really started, and I kind of counseled them about their periods and so on, and told them to be patient if they hadn't started yet. But that assembly day thing. Why did you have to wear a white shirt?
Oh, for the same reason we had to wear a red tie and a blue skirt. I mean, you know, who can understand these things? My guest is Mavis Jukes, author of It's a Girl Thing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mavis Jukes. Her new book, It's a Girl Thing, is a guide for preteens to puberty and sexuality. Jukes teaches at an elementary school and holds lunchtime sessions with girls in which she covers some of the same territory as her book.
I'm paired up with another teacher, a woman, a sixth grade teacher. And what we did is we started out by sending out parent permission slips and giving an overview of what the program would be at lunchtime. And then the girls whose parents approved were allowed to come for an hour once a week or 45 minutes once a week. And we ate lunch together and we just sat in a big circle. And we talked about a lot of the things that are in the It's a Girl Thing book, not every last thing that's in the It's a Girl Thing book, because I do have to follow the guidelines of the particular school district that I work in. But It was just a really wonderful experience because we got to do things that most people would just not really think of doing, like having a pad festival where I brought, you know, Velcro pads and maxis and minis and slims and you know, ones that pop open like pup tents and overnighters. And I just had hundreds of pads there. And we just kind of let the girls prowl through them. And pretty soon they were doing experiments, like seeing how much apple juice they could pour into one pad and that kind of thing. And it was just truly exhilarating. And we just wanted it to be all girls because we just felt that it would just be more relaxed, and I actually think it's a good idea for girls and boys to be separated for sex ed classes in school. But anyway, questions would come up, and we answered them, and we just had a fine time.
Mavis Jukes, you write books for young people. You are a mother as well, and I know you don't like to publicly discuss the lives of your children in order to protect their privacy. But I'm wondering if there's anything you can tell us about what was most problematic for you as a mother when you were trying to convey to your children the facts about sexuality and reproduction?
Well, I can tell you very truthfully that it was not problematic, but it's not because, you know, I had any, you know, unusually close relationship with my kids in regards to the material in this book. It's because they both had excellent human interactions classes in public school. And, you know, they were coming home with notes and worksheets and information and so on that, you know, I was learning stuff from. So I never really had any questions. Very reassuring that they were actually getting a lot of accurate information from school. And I would like to take a moment to add that many parents have conveyed to me a sense of distress sometimes, that they would like to discuss things more with their kids, but their kids don't seem to really want to talk that much. And I really honor that. I really respect that. And I understand that not all kids really want to talk to their parents about these issues, and I certainly didn't. And I ask people sometimes, well, when was the last time you felt like sitting down with your parents and you know, having a good talk about sex? And, of course, it's just a preposterous thought for most people, but some people do. I think it's rather usual for both parents and kids to feel some amount of reservations about talking about a lot of the stuff that's in this book. It's kind of a private read, really.
I think it probably says a lot about what young people are up against now to mention that your book includes these really delightful, funny stories about your first bra and the first time you started menstruating. And there's all kinds of, like, really well-given information about sex and puberty and so on. And in the same book, you caution young people about HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases and pregnancy and so on. And I mean, obviously, it's sex is both is potentially life threatening for young people now.
True.
And I guess, you know, you want to be careful that you're not scaring young people too much about sex, so that they're too afraid to ever enjoy it. You know what I mean? You don't want young people to grow up with this fear that will never go away. On the other hand, you want them to grow up really cautious and right, careful and responsible. Tell me a little bit about what balance you tried to strike in your book.
Well, the balance that I tried to strike in the book is remembering again that the book is for 6th, 7th, and 8th grade girls, I tried to really emphasize the importance of postponing having sex.
How do you do that?
Just kept on saying, you know, well, how do you do it? Really, the way I did it, and the way I think it really can and should be done, is to tell the kids the truth about the risks that are associated with having sex when you're too young to be able to assume the responsibilities of a sexual relationship. And you know, there are emotional risks as well as physical risks. And studies show that the more kids know about sex and the more parents talk to kids about sex, the more likely they are to postpone having sex for a long time, especially in this age group, which is way too young for for anyone to be engaging in sex with a partner, in my view. You just can't say, just don't do it. Just give kids the actual factual information and also clue them in on as to some of the responsibilities when they do reach a point in their lives where they're sexually engaged, you know, seeing an OBGYN doctor, family planning issues, types of birth control, and of course, above all, latex condoms and safer sex issues. But in addition to the issues around sex in this book, there's also a huge section on assault prevention, which I worked very hard on. And I will say that this book was really a hard book to write. Yes, there's those great lighthearted stories about first bras and first periods and sticking dimes in Kotex machines, but then it had to, you know, I needed to weave those stories into with other information that kids are entitled to know. And I think it is simply critical that kids, including teens, be completely aware of all the issues around potential sexual assault, and who to call, who to talk to, where to go, how to prevent it, how to recognize it. I've noticed in schools over the last 5 or 10 years that there's been a big emphasis on educating kids about stranger danger and so forth. But when you consider the fact that like 85% of all sexual assault of children and young teens is perpetrated by someone known to them, known to the family, often in a position of trust. See, sometimes we don't give the kids enough information. And I really tried in this book to just be very direct about, you know, the potential of what's out there and how kids can protect themselves from that.
Just one more thing. Something I find really interesting about your book, the only books that I've ever seen, you know, facts of life type books, aren't written with a point of view. They always seem to be written in this omniscient narrator point of view by nobody in particular, the way textbooks are. Just by this omniscient presence. And yours is the first one I've seen, maybe I've missed the others, you know, where it's a point of view where you're telling something about yourself and sharing information. And I think that's an interesting way of doing it.
Well, thank you for noticing that. I wanted the book to read kind of like, you know, a favorite aunt.
Talking
to you.
I
just wanted it to seem, well, it's true, though. I'm not everybody's favorite aunt, but I do. I'm very dedicated to youth and educating youth. And I just feel that having it be this type of a book where it's not some distant voice, but instead just a real person out there just telling you what happened to her, I just felt comfortable with doing it that way, and it seems to have worked.
Well, Mavis Jukes, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me to be on the program. I've really enjoyed it.
Mavis Jukes' new book is called It's a Girl Thing. She's the author of several other books for children and teenagers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Chastity Bono tells us about coming out to her parents, Sonny and Cher. Now she works with the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation as their liaison to the entertainment industry. And Ed Ward profiles teen idol Frankie Lyman, whose biggest hit was Why Do Fools Fall in Love?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You can still see the 2-year-old Chastity Bono on reruns of her parents' old variety show, The Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour. But that's hardly how she's making her mark on the entertainment industry now. She's consulting to the industry on the portrayal of gays. She's the entertainment media director of the activist group GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. She worked with the program Ellen on its coming out episodes. She's delighted to see that gays in the industry are beginning to come out, but she doesn't believe in outing. She knows what that's like. She was outed by the tabloid The Star in 1990 when she was 21. I asked Chastity what was going on in her life at the time.
I was trying to have a career in the record industry as a singer. I had just gotten signed to a development deal at Geffen Records, and then that happened, and it was a very scary time. I didn't know how it would affect my career at all. It was way before anybody had started coming out in the music industry, so kind of the school of thought at that time was, deny it and... if you were to come out, it would be have devastating effects career-wise.
Do you remember what the headline was?
No. Something like, Cher shattered as, lesbian daughter says she's gay or some such crap.
Was that annoying that even in the article outing you, it was your mother who had the first mention?
I didn't think of it. I was too busy being terrified.
Right.
To be annoyed.
So you were advised to deny it?
Yeah, I was.
Did you think that was good advice at the time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because, it was, nobody had done it yet. So the thinking was, it can't be done. You can't be, a successful recording artist and be out. And we now know that that's absolutely untrue. But unfortunately, it takes, some brave people to disprove that. And it wasn't until, I guess, 92 or 93 that Katie Lane came out and, proved to the world that you could be very successful and be out.
After you were outed by The Star, a tabloid, you were later outed again by Outweek, which was a gay publication, and the editor of that publication, Michael Signorilli, is, I think, the person who wrote the article. What was your reaction to being outed by the gay press?
I was really angry. I felt really betrayed. I was very much against the whole outing movement. I still am, though it's not really an issue anymore. But, I felt like I had been betrayed by my own community, basically.
And what was the rationale then for outing you?
I think the rationale for outing, period, was, just to try to bring awareness of the number of people that were gay and to try to get people to come out. And I think that was probably the rationale behind why they did it to me. I know it wasn't, a personal kind of attack like some of the other outings were. I think that kind of the gist of that story that was almost that, I was a victim of, the establishment or the horrible record industry that was, making me stay in the closet, which really wasn't true. I was advised that way, but it was certainly my decision. It wasn't like I wanted to come out and was told I couldn't,
When you were outed by a tabloid, your strategy was deny it. And let's face it, who really trusts the tabloids anyways?
Right.
But when you were outed by Outweek, which is a real, inside publication,
right,
could you have denied it then?
Well, it was the number of people that were reading Outweek. It was just a small number of the gay community. Outweek wasn't even a magazine like Out or The Advocate is now. So it didn't really worry me. It just angered me.
So what was your strategy after that?
It didn't change.
Didn't change. When did you decide to come out, and
right,
why did you decide to do it at that time?
I decided to come out in the beginning of 95 in The Advocate, and I had just started writing for them. And at that point, it seemed, almost hypocritical to be writing for a gay magazine and to not be out. And I had already started at that, probably for the year before, like the year of before that, 94, I was really living my life completely out. I just hadn't made a formal announcement of it. And I didn't care anymore. I was just waiting for the right moment to actually do it in print. And so once I started working for The Advocate and doing feature articles for them, I was proud of what I was doing and wanted to get more involved with work in the gay and lesbian community. And so it was the right time.
What kind of reaction did you get, and how did that compare to what you had expected?
I got an unbelievably overwhelming positive reaction, and reached a huge number of people. And I think I was surprised just how much really great feedback I got from it. It was like a very personal decision, and something that I was ready to do, and didn't really think so much about what the response would be to it. It was just something that I felt I needed to do. And so to have so much, really great feedback and responses come back at me was kind of a surprise. A nice surprise.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Chastity Bono, and she's the Entertainment Media Director for GLAAD, which is the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. Tell me how your parents found out that that you were gay. They knew by the time you came out. They knew before you were outed.
Well, yeah. I came out to my dad when I was 18. And then...
How did that happen, could you say?
I just finally made the decision to do it. I had a really close relationship with him at the time. And, again, was just sick of hiding such a huge part of my life to him, and finally mustered up the courage to do that and tell him. And then I met my first kind of serious girlfriend not long after that, and my mom, I guess, kind of suspected that there was something different going on with me, and talked to my dad about it, and he confirmed it to her.
What was your father's reaction when you came out? Your father is Sonny Bono, who is a congressman now, who has voted against gay legislation, such as he co-sponsored the Defense of Marriage Act, which denies federal recognition of same-sex marriages and allows states not to recognize same-sex marriages licensed in other states.
Right.
So what was his reaction to his daughter coming out?
He was wonderful. He really, it was kind of the picture-perfect reaction you could hope from a parent. Just, love you, accept you. I thought this was what you were going to tell me anyway, and, it doesn't matter, kind of a thing.
How do you explain the disparity between the way he's been voting in Congress and his personal reaction to your coming out?
I think it's just party politics, and it's very hypocritical.
So you think that he's not, in his heart of hearts, opposed to gay people or gay rights?
No, I know he's not.
So you think he wants to just stay on the good side of his party?
Yeah. I mean, I have talked to him. I did an interview with him for The Advocate where he said that he would, support gay marriages. And then, I guess a year later, he was co-sponsoring DOMA. So I don't think that he doesn't have a problem with gay people in the slightest. He's got, many gay friends. He says he's had gay people working for him. It's just towing the party line.
Your mother has said, I think, that her initial reaction was to throw you out of the house.
Yeah.
I was just so surprised at that, because your mother, Cher, seems so open-minded, and she has such a large gay male following. I mean, half the performing drag queens do Cher in their act. So I was just kind of surprised that she'd be angry with you.
Well, I don't know that she was angry. I think that she was just feeling, numerous different emotions. And, I think that she reacted very typically to the way parents react to that. And it wasn't It wasn't a matter of you know, homophobia or, you know, having a problem with gay people, because we, you know, always had gay people very close to the family growing up. But it was, you know, that all of a sudden now this is her daughter, and so you had all these different, you know, things playing into it, fear and, you know, guilt and, you know, what did I do wrong? And all that, you know, all the really typical things that parents feel. You know, she threw me out of the house, but it lasted for about, you know, 3 or 4 days. So it wasn't like, you know, she kind of blew up and then we started to try to deal with it.
Now, we've talked about how you were outed when you decided to come out, how uh-huh. your parents found out you were gay. How did you find out you were gay? How did you realize that?
Well, I think that I always felt different as a child and didn't really exactly know what that difference was. But never really felt like I fit in with other little girls when I was really young. And always had a lot of friends that were boys and was just kind of that classic tomboy. And then as I got older and, you know, I started to hit puberty, it just, I kind of figured it out. And I think the light bulb finally really went off when I saw the movie Personal Best. All of a sudden kind of hit me what this difference that I was feeling really was.
My guest is Chastity Bono. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Chastity Bono is my guest, and she's now the entertainment media director for GLAAD, which is the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. You consulted to the show Ellen mm-hmm. when Ellen the actress and Ellen the character were coming out. What kind of advice did you give? What were you asked about?
I appeared on the episode that follows the original coming out episode, and so I was on the set and just kind of started.
Is this the episode where she tells her parents?
Where she tells her parents, yeah. And just kind of started kind of giving my 2 cents. And they listened, which was nice. And it was really about, I mean, you know, there was nothing at all that was, you know, offensive about the show or, you know, truly inaccurate. It was more, you know, little things like, you know, changing lines here or there. You know, a lot of stuff in the scene where she comes out to her parents and in the scene at the council group that I'm in at the end where, you know, they had Ellen saying a lot of the lines that ended up going to me and to Lorraine Newman. And you know, I kind of said Ellen wouldn't be saying this. She wouldn't be sophisticated enough, you know, in her coming out process to use this type of language. And, you know, this is something that, you know, she might say a couple of years down the line, but not at this point. And so...
What were those things that you thought were too sophisticated for the moment?
I don't remember the exact lines. It's, you know, there's a line that I said something about, you know, it's easier to live your life openly. You know, sometimes it's more easy to live your life openly and honestly than to live a lie. That's not something that somebody who just started their coming out process would say. It is something that a counselor would say. So it was that kind of stuff.
Any time that there's a TV show with a gay character or a movie with a gay character, do you feel like it's your duty to go see it?
Uh-huh, yeah, I do.
So what have you been seeing lately on TV and in movie theaters?
Well, not a lot of TV because we're in reruns now.
Reruns, right.
But I just saw my best friend's wedding, which I thought was wonderful. And
critique of the gay character in it?
It was great. I mean, actually one of the best portrayals I've seen, and something that I don't think we've seen before. I mean, Rupert Everett in my opinion, really still the film, and I think in a lot of other people's opinions as well.
And he's come out as an actor, too, right?
He's been out. He's been out for many, many years. So, and it was just, you know, he managed, I think, to be really kind of sexy and charming as a gay person, which is something you don't really see that often. And, you know, now there he's got three projects in the works right now. So, you know, a lot of other people were equally impressed by his performance. That was great and really exciting. Just recently saw Con Air, which was kind of a really bad portrayal of a gay person. And we are going to be talking to the producer of that film.
What are you going to say?
Well, you know, kind of try to explain why it was bad and why that character was offensive to people.
I haven't seen the movie. Tell me what was offensive to you about it.
What was offensive was that it was really a character that was just there for the sake of kind of making fun of and laughing at. And there was no depth to the character, and there was no value to him as far as plot or storyline. There was no need for him to be there other than to pop up, you know, periodically in a buffoonish manner and be laughed at. And so, you know, we need to, you know, just talk to the producers and explain why that isn't okay. Why that kind of a portrayal will, you know, come up against criticism.
Now, tell me how you play this. There is a kind of line between trying to raise people's consciousness and generate awareness about, you know, sexual stereotypes and gender stereotypes. There's a line between that and being like the political correctness police.
Right.
So where do you draw that line?
I mean, this is an instance of now there's been two portrayals by the same producer who did the Rock last year, which also had a really stereotypical gay character, and now the Sharon Con Air. So there's a pattern here developing, and you know, when I made the call, he had already you know, gotten tons and tons of criticism, you know, not only from the press but also from just people within the entertainment industry, gay and straight people, just kind of saying you know this is not okay, and so you know there's a definite willingness on their part to meet with us. And you know, I think that for the most part in Hollywood, people don't want to offend people or turn people off, and I think there's a genuine kind of feeling coming from them, like, well, what did we do wrong, and why was the Birdcage okay, and the fact that those characters were stereotypical but this character isn't. And so I think it's you know, for GLAAD, just a matter of getting in and trying to educate and trying to work with them so this doesn't happen in the future.
You said earlier that it's when you saw the movie Personal Best,
mm-hmm.
Which is about a young woman who's an athlete who realizes that she's gay. That's when you realized that you were gay, too, watching mm-hmm. that movie.
Right.
Since watching a movie was such a formative experience for you, is it particularly important to you how gays and lesbians are portrayed in movies and on television?
Well, I think also especially since taking the job at GLAAD and now having thought about it, I think it's interesting that, you know, here I grew up surrounded by gay people all the time, and yet it took seeing a movie for it to register with me. So I think it shows the power that the media has for gay and lesbian people, for everybody, really, and how, you know, it really helps to shape us. And so, yeah, I think it illustrates the importance of diverse portrayals of gays and lesbians.
Let me ask you this. This might seem as an odd question, but it seems to me like in the entertainment industry, if you were singing or acting or something, your parents had kind of been there first. But in the area of gay rights, I mean, there's no way anyone could say to you, oh, sure, well, you're a gay activist because your mother was there first and she did it so well. or, you know, your father did it so well. Has it been liberating for you in that respect, too, to
totally.
Do something in which you're really your own person?
Yeah, no, it's been amazing. It has been. It's been really liberating for that reason. I mean, when I was in the music industry, everything that I did was in comparison to my parents, you know. Every article and everything was like, you know, she sounds like her mother. She doesn't sound like her mother. Her music's like her parents was. It's not at all, you know, everything was just in comparison to that. And you know, like you said, they've never done this type of work. There is no comparison. You know, it's something wholly my own, and so that is nice.
Chastity Bono, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Chastity Bono is the Entertainment Media Director for GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Frankie Lyman. This is Fresh Air. Two decades before the Jackson Five propelled little Michael Jackson to fame, America had fallen in love with 13-year-old Frankie Lyman and his group, The Teenagers. The two stories, though, turned out very differently. Rock historian Ed Ward has this profile of Frankie Lyman.
The tragedy of Frankie Lyman is one of the better-known tales of 50s rock and roll. A star at 13, singing Why Do Fools Fall in Love, a song he'd written out of unrequited love for one of his teachers, he and his group, The Teenagers, rocketed to stardom in 1955. A year and a half of chart-topping and movie appearances followed, culminating in the group's going to London to headline the Palladium and record at Abbey Road Studios. Then, record biz Sharks whispered in little Frankie's ear, telling him he'd be a bigger star without the other guys. He wasn't. 4 years after his hit stopped coming, Frankie was dropped by his label, and 7 years after that, he was found dead of a drug overdose on the floor of his grandmother's kitchen. He was 25. A nice tale, but not exactly true. For starters, Fools was written by Jimmy Merchant and Herman Santiago, two of the teenagers, a fact that was finally determined in court in 1992, by which time they were the only two of the original five still alive. For another thing, the group's star started falling well before Frankie was separated from them.
I'm not a juvenile delinquent.
No, 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 I'm not a juvenile delinquent. Do the thing that's right.
I'm Not a Juvenile Delinquent from 1956 didn't even chart, possibly because it has some of the worst lyrics ever committed to vinyl, as you can hear. It did, however, do very well in Britain. That's where things started going wrong.
So you met someone who set you back on your heels. Goody, goody. So you met someone and now you know how it feels. Goody, goody. So you gave him your heart too. Just as I gave mine to you. And he broke it in little pieces. And now how do you do? So you lie awake just singing.
Goody, goody. A Johnny Mercer standard was recorded at Abbey Road during the group's 1957 tour using British backup singers. Because it did okay in the States, the record label probably figured that one, Frankie was better off without the others, and two, a more adult approach was the way to go. The teenagers continued to record more, well, teenage stuff. It didn't get pushed, and it didn't sell. But Frankie's career stalled too. After Goody Goody, the hits stopped. Not only that, his voice started changing, but as he proved on an impossibly rare 1958 album simply titled Rock and Roll, he was becoming a better singer.
Next time you see me, things won't be the same. Yes, next time you see me, baby, things won't be the same. And if it hurts you, my darling,
the album has him covering hits of the period from Junior Parker's Next Time You See Me to a version of Paul Anka's Diana that buries the original. His last U.S. chart entry, a version of Little Bitty Pretty One, belatedly released in 1960, came from this album. Too bad. As this 1961 release shows, his voice was getting better as he matured, even if he was recording junk.
Is it wrong for me to dream? When it's you I'm dreaming of, is it wrong for me to be so young and so in love? Is it right?
The 1950s was a time when it was assumed that there was talent on every street corner. There was, but not all of it was of equal quality. The tragedy of Frankie Lyman was that his was wasted by an ignorant record company, and for whatever reason, he did nothing to stop it.
Ed Ward writes about music and lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Cherie Gross.
Doo-bop-si-doo, boom-ba-boom-boom-boom, doo-bop-si-doo, boom-ba-boom-boom-boom.
I'll always want you, because my heart is true.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.